Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast, a show focused on inspiring and empowering you to become a better writer. Come along as we deconstruct the tips, routines, and motivations of your favorite authors. In the end, it's all about getting your story onto the page. Welcome to episode 89, How Omar El Akkad Writes. I am so excited to welcome Omar back for a second time to the show. Omar was actually my very first real interview for the podcast. So if you go back and listen to it, and I sound super nervous, that was why. All the way back on episode 3, kind of unreal to look back on that time frame. I love Omar's work. And when I saw he had a brand new novel out in the world, What Strange Paradise, I knew I wanted him back on the show. Omar is always, he's so wise and insightful. I feel as if every time I speak with him, I go through a kind of storytelling masterclass. This interview is a deep dive into his writing process, some insights on the difference between writing book one and book two, and how he uses real events to create story. I want to thank Omar one more time for his time and his generosity. And now, my friends, without any further ado, here is the interview with Omar El Akkad. Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast. I'm your host, Brian, and today is a special day because I'm so excited to welcome back Omar El Akkad. Omar is an author and journalist. He was born in Egypt, grew up in Qatar, moved to Canada as a teenager, and now lives in the United States. In his work as a journalist, Omar covered the war on terror, the war in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and tons of other international issues. His debut novel, American War, was an international bestseller and has been translated into over 13 languages. It was listed as one of the best books of the year by the New York Times, Washington Post, GQ, NPR, Esquire, and was selected by the BBC as one of the 100 novels that changed our world. That's how I was introduced to Omar, and it is a fantastic, fantastic read. His latest novel, What Strange Paradise, was released on July 20th, 2021, at least in the United States. It is a fantastic and haunting and beautiful. It's a read that sticks with you. You know, you don't just read it and go, okay, on to the next one. Like I found myself sitting with that book for a really long time. Omar, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Different topic. I'm so excited to have you back. So I didn't tell you this when we were just chatting before we got started, but you were, Mr. Omar, the very first podcast interview I did. I recorded a bunch in a batch to see if I can even do this thing. And you were the first one that I interviewed. And it's kind of surreal to have you back now, a year and a half later, back on the show. And I wanted to ask, how's the past like year and a half or so been? Like, how has this season been for you? When we spoke, it was right before COVID. And so life changed a lot. And just wondering, like, how's it been?
I'm trying to think of the sort of person who's going to be like, it was great the last year and a half, just like the best, you know, like the kind of sociopath who's going to be like, yeah, it was a fantastic year. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't paying much attention to the news, so I'm not sure if anything was going on.
Yeah.
It's very strange because I'm thinking of this in terms of obviously how writers write and how the last year affected my writing or lack thereof. And one of the things that I have had to come to terms with over the last sort of 18 months is the idea that as much as I love uncertainty within the work when I'm writing, I love that sense of not being on solid footing when you're inside the work. Mm-hmm. As much as I love that, I despise it when it leaks outside the work into real life. When life is unstable, it makes it so much harder to put anything together. And so it's been a very difficult year writing wise and also reading wise. And I'm having a hard time sort of keeping up with the works that I'm reading and with the narratives. But I suspect that's the case for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's just this kind of like brain turning to mush from a combination of monotony and anxiety. So it's been that. How about you?
I think similar. In a lot of ways, I used the past year and a half. I decided I was going to try and be busier than I had ever been. My coping strategy was to be how little can I sleep? Cause I keep taking on new things to do. And that seemed to work for a little bit. And then I think as soon as things slowed down, I found the same thing. And a lot of the people I've interviewed, as well as just kind of writers within our network, have kind of expressed the same thing, that it's been so challenging to be consistent in writing. Challenging to actually show up. To get something done, it takes a long time. you got to do it a lot, and it's been so challenging to do that. So What Strange Paradise, did you write this during the pandemic? Was it done before the pandemic kicked off? I wanted to ask you, how did it go? Because it seems as if you would have been working on it right in the meat of it all.
It was substantially, but not completely done by the time of the pandemic. I started thinking about the book almost a decade ago. Started thinking about the things that eventually became the book. Started writing it before American War came out, but after American War had been sold. And just went through rewrite after rewrite. It's one of those books that kept getting shorter the more I worked on it. It became very quickly that kind of book. I think there's certain projects you go into and think, this is going to be expansive. This is going to be the world. This is going to be a kitchen sink kind of book. And American War is very much a kitchen sink kind of book.
Yeah.
And this one, midway through the process, it occurred to me that what this needed was shorter sharpness. I needed to get down to the line level and make every word count. And so that was the process I was going through towards the very end, during the sort of early mid COVID era.
Was
that tightening process.
Okay. So how did you come up with that? I have a lot of people ask and want to know, how do you know what to cut and how do you know what to keep? What's that toolbox look like? And so I'm curious, what was that process like for you?
So the way I think about it is, there are certain areas in which I have real deficiencies as a writer. There's many areas in which I have real deficiencies as a writer. And one of those many areas is early draft bias. So I tend to think of when you're working on a longer project, a novel length project, the architecture metaphor can only sort of take you so far, but there is some use to it, right?
Yeah,
you start by surveying the area and, do I have any right to build here? Is it going to gentrify the neighborhood? Is it going to take up space from better structures? That sort of thing. Once you get into the construction and you put the blueprint together, and I've got tons of sort of maps and documents lying around all over this room right now that are sort of the blueprints. The first draft, I try my best not to focus on the decoration in the building. I'm going to put lamps all over the room so I can see what the hell I'm doing, but I'm going to think of them as expendable in the long run. What I'm focused on early on is the load-bearing beams, the things that structurally are going to hold up the novel. Because if later on I have to replace a lamp, if there's a sentence I thought was beautiful 2 years ago and now I read it and think it's absolute garbage, I can replace a lamp.
It's pretty easy.
But if I'm replacing load-bearing beams after the drywall's up and, we've moved in couches and stuff, that's an issue. So part of it is trying to get at this notion of just because something ended up there in the first draft doesn't mean it's sacrosanct and sort of sacred and you can't touch it. And you try to clean up with that element in mind. I don't subscribe to this notion of kill your darlings. Take good care of your darlings. They're your darlings for a reason. But also don't feel obligated to them, I think.
Yeah. One of the things you described that, I think since I started the podcast, so you talk about some of the things that have changed, is this awareness that I've had of how important the process of creation is. And I always say creativity is magic. When you touch into creativity, you're touching, to me, I believe you're touching another world. You're touching something that connects all people. you know, it doesn't matter when you were born or where you were born, creativity, that sense that art is what art is bloomed from, what storytelling comes from, is magic to me, truly magic. But the actual process of turning that creativity into a book is a process, right? It's wonky and mechanical. And I do think that that architecture metaphor holds up in a lot of ways because architects are mechanical. They have a process by which they build a building. They don't say, how should we do this each time? They know the process. And so I'm curious, like, do you look at novel writing in the same way? Do you look at it as a process? Do you look at it as something that has a pattern to it, if not exactly the same, similarly the same with each one?
This is a really good question. And I think you touched on something that's really vital when we talk about the process, mm-hmm. because there's an interior process and then there's an exterior process. And the exterior process is poisoned by capitalism. You know, writing a book is a very different thing from publishing a book. And when the concerns of one start to bleed into the other,
yeah,
then you have problems. So when I was writing American War, I didn't have a book deal or an agent or a publisher. I was writing in my spare time. I was still working as a journalist at the time. And so I was free from any of those constraints and any of those concerns. And then, you know, fast forward, American War did well by my standards. It didn't sell, you know, millions of copies, but it certainly did far better than I expected. Fast forward to me writing What Strange Paradise. And there's so much wasted brain power on, oh, what will my readers think of this? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, is it going to be too different from the previous book? What mm-hmm. will, the, you know, and all of that stuff is really toxic to what you talked about, the process of just creation, of going to the place, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. and I can't describe the place to you. I can't tell you how you get there, but when you do, yeah. my God, that's all of it right there, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
But if you're yeah. constantly thinking about the concerns of the sort of audience facing side of things and the industry facing side of things, it does nothing but diminish the work. So for better or worse, What Strange Paradise is a very different book from American War, sort of structurally, narratively, maybe not thematically, maybe not in terms of what I was concerned with in the world when I was yeah. writing it, but it's a very different book. And I wasted so much energy, so much psychic energy, worrying about what that means for the reader facing side of me. And I would urge any writer to, as much as possible, shut the door on those concerns.
Yeah.
Get to the place, whatever comes out of the place is its own reward. Everything else is tainted by capitalism anyway. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it's yeah. usually for bad reasons.
And it's hugely out of your control, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a huge part of, you know, the publishing process and books that make it and are, you know, unbelievable bestsellers and books that undersell, that have very, you as the author have very little control over. Like sometimes I find a book and I read it and I'm like, how in the world is this not this unbelievable bestseller? Because it just, it rocks me to my core. And then I read some other bestsellers and I'm like, this is absolute garbage. Like how in the world is this it? This is the book we all want to buy? Like this is the one? And that's not to disparage someone else's work. It's more to call out that there's a randomness to it. You know what I mean? Like there's just complete chaos to that process.
Yeah. And I mean, I also don't want it to sort of dull my capacity for sort of acknowledging the manyness of the world. Because right. there's been many times where, you know, I've read a book and I've had the same situation, you know, the same reaction of really this yeah. is the one that, and there's this like New York Times book podcast thing where at the end of every episode, I don't know if this still exists, but at the end of every episode, they would tell you the bestsellers, you know, like this week's bestseller. And you can hear the sort of groaning in the voices mm-hmm. of these people who are book lovers who are just like, yep, this book written by this famous person right. is still number one, you know?
Right.
And you can tell that they're thinking like, and it's horrible, I hate it. But also like, if it brings joy to somebody and if it, you know,
right.
it may not, I may not be the person that does that too, but it must be doing something. So I try my best to shut all of that out when I'm in the process because
yeah.
there's no good can come of it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the things you learned from book one to book two. So I know you published a bunch of short stories. In fact, I know you were in, I randomly was reading an anthology about like the end of the world. I don't know how it got in my hands. And I started reading a short story and I didn't even read the author. I just started reading it. I was like, oh, who wrote this one? So I was a couple pages in. I was like, man, this is really good. Who wrote this? And I flipped back and it was you. And I was like, oh, no wonder. So I know you've done a bunch of short stories, a bunch of anthologies, but like, what do you feel like were the big lessons you learned between book number one and book number two?
I think one of the things that sticks with me is that I'm more comfortable now with the idea of every novel, every book being, and I talk about this a lot, this idea that every book is a eulogy for the version of you that wrote it. Because of the nature of putting these things out into the world is that it takes years and years and years after the thing is done before it shows up on a bookshelf. And so inevitably what you're doing is going out into the world speaking on behalf of a previous you. And when I was writing American War, not so much when I was writing it, but when it was out in the world and I was going around doing interviews mm-hmm. and doing events, I was really uncomfortable with that because part of me wanted to have that conversation with the previous me and talk about the things that I thought could have been better, the things that I, you know, thought were flaws in the book, but that's not how you're supposed to approach this process. You're supposed to go out and try to get people to read the damn thing and buy it. And I'm a lot more comfortable sort of talking about that asynchronous, you know, sort of anti-chronological nature of the process now.
That's interesting. I've never
the other thing, and this is, it's odd, right? Because I came from a journalism background where the default is, hey, we need this story yesterday. You know, you have 20 minutes, get us the quote, sort of timeline. And suddenly you switch to something like novel writing, where the process itself is so elongated relative to journalism, daily journalism, but also is the finished product has a far longer life. You know, newspapers, you get this short, sharp spike after every article and then it's gone. And the books just kind of linger long after you're dead. Mm-hmm. They're sitting mm-hmm. on a bookshelf somewhere collecting dust. So dealing with the bizarre chronology of it all was a thing that I had to come to terms with. The other thing, and probably the most important thing that I learned between the books, is the importance of sort of forgiving yourself for the imperfect thing that it inevitably becomes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the process is for other writers, but for me, there's these sort of diamonds of crystal thought. Every sentence in my head is perfectly crafted. The thing I want to say, the text, the subtext, all of it works so well. And then in the process of transference onto the page, everything falls apart. And when you have an entire novel of that process, it's really easy to learn to despise it and be sort of perpetually disappointed by what it is relative to what it could have been. And I think now I have an easier time looking at the work and seeing the places where the gears do fit.
Right.
And where it does something important or something beautiful. That has helped me a lot.
I feel like there's a real analogy there to parenting. You know, because both parenting and novel writing, I think, teach you very quickly that you're a person and imperfect. And, you know, it really comes to grasp, or you really kind of have to come to grasp with your humanity when you realize, despite your best efforts, it wasn't what you wanted. And you're just a person. You know what I mean? Like, you're still just a person. You only have certain abilities and faculties. And there's a mystery anyways. Like, I don't know if anyone's ever nailed it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know. It's like people living to 150. I don't even know if it's possible, you know? But it's an interesting analogy there of like the frustration, but also the joy in it. I don't know. Kids and novels.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the central parenting, like the central parenting analogy is that, you go in, or at least I went in, thinking that the optimum outcome is good, well-behaved, does what I need it to do, you know. And very quickly I realized that that's not the optimum outcome. That's the very selfish outcome. The optimum outcome is for this living thing to have a life of its own,
yeah,
and to do the things it wants to do.
Yeah.
You know, if the book comes out and has a completely different impact on the world than you thought, but it has that impact, that to me is an incredible success. And I think the same thing with children, you know, like I like rock climbing. If my daughter becomes an expert rock climber, fantastic. If she becomes, you know, if she does whatever she wants and is good at it and loves it, that's a far better success than her sort of doing the thing that I like or whatever.
Right, right. Yeah. So in your novels, one of the things you tackle big topics, you take on world topics, you know, I mean, they're seem to be rooted at least in part, especially I feel like What's Strange Paradise is rooted in real events that are going on, but narratives within those events. And I'm curious, do you think about those topics as like a topic you want to explore more? Is there a sense of there's a character and then you realize they're within, you know, certain type of experience? How does that work? Because I think a lot of people want to write, especially in our world now. Let me just add a little bit more to this question. And I'm awful at doing this, so just forgive me because I add way more detail to questions than what I should. But
no,
here we
please
are.
Please do. Those are the best questions.
But here we are. So I think a lot of writers want to take on a complex topic. They want to take on something like, you know, a refugee crisis. They want to take on something like this division and disparity that's happening in our country. They want to take these things on, but don't know how to do it without being preachy. And you do such a good job at this in both of your novels, where you take on these big topics without hammering somebody over the head with a theme. And so I'm wondering, like, how do you approach that? How do you pull that off?
So the central caveats before I answer is that A, I have no idea if I'm any good at this. And
you
B,
are.
I have no idea if I have any right to do this. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
I can at least answer the first one. The second
one,
I don't know.
At the end of the day, both as a yeah, so you know, as a journalist first and then as a novelist, because of the subject matter that I choose to cover, I am perpetually a tourist in someone else's misery. These things that I write about are based in events and injustices and systemic injustices that are not invented.
Mm-hmm.
These things happen to people. When I wrote American War, I didn't invent drone killings.
Right.
I didn't invent waterboarding. I didn't invent any of those things. I didn't invent the refugee crisis for What Strange Paradise. So there is this sense of being in this incredibly privileged position of being a tourist in someone else's misery, and then being able to leave afterwards. And I don't know if I have the right to do this, and I don't know how much longer I can keep doing this and sort of setting aside that question. All of that said, I write about the things that make me angry. That is inevitably what works its way into my fiction, particularly my long form fiction. I think this notion of worrying about being preachy is really important and insidious, because it comes from this sort of MFA school of writing. I have nothing against MFAs. Some of my favorite writers have come up through the North American sort of MFA machine. But this notion of not saying the thing makes for some really good writing, but also has some real implicit assumptions based into it. One of my favorite poets, Marwa Hilal, has this line that I quote all the time. They will say, show, don't tell, but that assumes most people can see. For someone like Hemingway to go around saying, you know, don't say the thing, the iceberg principle, you know, say only 1/10 of what you know, and so on and so forth, all of that makes for some amazing writing. But he had the Victorians yelling on his behalf for generations before he wrote a single word. There are things that he can safely not say, knowing full well that the lineage in which he is writing says those things for him. So, you know, he can write a book called The Sun Also Rises, knowing full well that everybody's going to get the reference in that title.
Yeah.
Faulkner can write a book called As I Lay Dying, knowing full well that people are going to get the reference in that title because of the lineage in which this is operating. If you are coming from outside of that, if you are, in my case, an immigrant to this part of the world from an entirely different culture, if you are coming from an identity group that has traditionally not had their stories be considered worthy of publication, you're having to do a lot of both showing and telling. And so, yes, absolutely. You worry about being preachy and not too preachy and so on and so forth. But understand that that particular piece of advice is rooted in a kind of privilege that you may not have, and proceed accordingly. Because if I end up being some future generation's Victorians, if I do the yelling so that someone else doesn't have to, I am quite happy with having that place in the world of writing. That's fine by me. But I don't think stepping away from big topics or contemporary topics or what is generally defined as the political, you know, I don't think that that is something that is at odds with true literature, whatever that might be. The political imposes itself on my writing and I proceed accordingly. I have no choice.
Yeah. That it's there's so many things you said in that to kind of pull apart and unpack. That's like sometimes in the show you get like answers that are like worth the price of admission in one answer, and that to me was one of them. You know what I mean? You just like worth it right there. So we're talking about tackling these big topics and how to, you know, kind of touch on things that are in the news, in politics, you know, maybe tragedy or trauma in somebody else's life. As a writer, how do you get access into that? How do you write those characters in a way that is respectful, that is telling their story, that is, you know, doing the work in a way that you feel like, I think you said this, do I have a right to do it? Like how do you then, how then do you get all of those things on the page, but also say, I do have a right to get this story out from me. This is a story I need to tell.
I mean, I should say that I fail more than I succeed on that front. There's a lot of, you know, there's three unpublishable novels, there's plenty of short stories and screenplays where I've attacked that particular topic and realized, sometimes at the very end, sometimes after I finished the whole damn thing, that I didn't do it. I didn't get it right. And I think deep down, you know, and it's just a question then of whether your desire to put the work out into the world supersedes that knowing, whether you think, no, I want this out there more than I want to face the reality of it. So a lot of this is tied up with the notion of empathy, which a lot of writers, including my favorite, some of my favorite writers, have really turned on in recent years, this notion that's the good of literature. I don't think it's the only good of literature, but I think one of the reasons a lot of writers have turned on the notion of empathy is because, particularly in North America, it's very much intertwined with individualism and the kind of individualistic society that we've largely created, where the notion is, you know, I need to feel someone else's pain. And also, if I feel it hard enough, I can fix it, because individual agency has to sort of reign over everything at the end of the day. And I think if you can pull that second half away, you're left with a viable function of empathy that relates to its original meaning from the original German, which is to feel into. The flip side of that is once you approach it that way, the negative side is that, or not so much negative, but the thing you have to contend with is that you will be left in a very uncertain space. And the novels that I write have that quality to them. There's no answers. Do this and do this and everything will work out. So you have to be comfortable with that side of things. I think in order to be able to approach someone else's suffering from a position other than one that leaves your personal agency paramount, I think if you're approaching it that way, you're almost inevitably going to fail.
I like that so much. I've time for just kind of one more kind of tree of questions here for you. And it's something that I noticed when I was reading What Strange Paradise, kind of connected it to American War, which is in your novels, you write using children and younger people. And I tend not to ask, you know, specific craft, like, why'd you do this with this character, whatever it might be. But I'm going to make a slight exception here to the rule. maybe the first time I've even done this, bah-bah. But what is it that you're drawn to as you write children? What is it from a story perspective, not necessarily a narrative perspective, but like from the construction of a story that, you know, you say, you know, a child is the lens through which I want to put this story?
So in the case of What Strange Paradise specifically, there were a number of sort of surface level specific reasons. Mm-hmm. One is that, so the interaction between the two central characters in the story, the two children, takes place in a kind of made up physical language. They don't speak the same language. And so they're forced to sort of, you know, make up all kinds of ways of communicating with each other. And that was something I did a lot as a kid, because I grew up in a place called Qatar, this little peninsula sticking out of Saudi Arabia, which was 90% non-Qatari. 90% of the population were from somewhere else. Mm. You know, they came to cash in on the oil and gas money. So you'd be at the playground or the beach or something, and you'd constantly be in this situation where you're communicating in that way. So a lot of my sort of childhood memories seeped into the story. But the central reason in both American War and What Strange Paradise, at a sort of overarching level, is that I think childhood is the site of our only really honest interaction with the world before mm-hmm. we're taught all of the mechanisms to simply exist in the world as a grown-up. All the lies you have to tell yourself, all the lies you have to tell everyone else just to sort of get through the day. And because I'm writing almost all of the time in some way or another about systemic injustice, filtering it through the prism of the only honest interaction, filtering it through the prism of a child's interaction with the world, I think highlights how glaring the wrong is. So it affords me both the honesty of that time of life, but also to show the wrongness for what it is. Now, do I get any of this right? Again, I don't know, but it's what I'm attracted to as a writer, is that prism of honest interaction with the world, as a site for what are generally some really awful things that I write about.
Yeah, and that's interesting. As I was reading What Strange Paradise, the one thing that came up to me as I read, you talk about not knowing if it's a good idea or bad idea, but I read every night kind of the old folk tales and mm-hmm. old myths to my children. And often they're with children. And in the case of some of the Grimm stories, especially, there's really awful things that happen to children. I mean, like, they're not, we have, I think, a very sanitized view of what is allowed, what you're allowed to do to kids in stories and what you're not allowed to do in kids in stories. And I think for good reason, like I'm grateful for that. You know, I enjoy stories that aren't intentionally cruel to children, but that said, there is a lot of brutality that happens in those old folks and folk tales. I mean, kids get snatched and boiled and eaten and all the things, you know, and it made me wonder as I was reading A Strange Paradise, like, do you view that novel as kind of a fable in some ways? Does it have like a fabulistic quality where you have two children? And I don't want to give too much of the novel away. I can't speak highly enough for it. If you haven't read it, go get it right now. But do you view it as a fable of sorts?
I view it almost exclusively as a fable. One of the things about What Strange Paradise is that it is, on a surface level, a very straightforward book, narratively mm-hmm. speaking. You know, it's only got really one structural conceit where it moves back and forth in time, but it's a pretty straightforward movement. Beneath the surface, it's a very different book, depending on how familiar you are with Peter Pan and the life of J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan.
Interesting.
Or the Book of Nicodemus from the Apocrypha, which I stole a ton from, or Paradise Lost, or you know, there's a number of these works that form the substructure, the underpinnings, and you don't need to know a single thing about any of these books to read the work for what it is, but it does have that undercurrent. For me, fables are almost always in some way a kind of conversation with mortality. I mean, mm-hmm. death is exclusively a fabulistic place. We don't know what happens on the other side. And some of the greatest stories in human history have been about all of the possible interpretations of what happens on the other side.
Yeah.
And so, again, without giving, you know, too much away from this book, which, again, is a very different book, depending on how familiar you are with the two, particularly the two stories in the epigraph, Peter Pan and a short story called An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. You know, without giving away too much about that, it is very much in my mind a fable first and foremost.
That's so interesting. I'm not super familiar with either one of those. I mean, no more than watching Peter Pan as a movie, which I'm sure is very different than the story itself. I've never read the story itself. But it's interesting that it speaks to your quality that came through. That it felt like a fable. As I was reading it, I didn't intellectually feel that way until I was reading a couple nights later. I was reading a fable to my kids, and I was like, man, that book felt like a fable. It had the flow of a fable. It had like the, I don't even know how to describe it, of a fable. Interesting.
I mean, thank you for that. That's incredibly reassuring. The aftertaste and getting the aftertaste of a fable in there is knowing that it's there makes me very, very happy. Thank you.
It certainly was for me. I mean, I certainly picked it up. I got it. And like I said, I had to sit with What Strange Paradise for a while. I had to kind of, and again, I don't want to give it away for anybody who's going to read it. I mean, I really encourage you to go get it, but I had to really just let it marinate. I feel like one of those first images I placed as being a news story. I mean, I remember there was a picture of a boy on a beach kind of face down, and I was like, I wonder if Omar this was a spark part of the journey of telling this story, because it has a similar kind of, I don't think that's giving away too much, but it certainly has that similar kind of setup as well to it. But I had to sit with a lot of it.
Yeah, it's. I mean, certainly that photo, the photo of, mm-hmm. as well of the man and his daughter who were trying to cross into this country. That was, I think, a year or two later. There are these sort of iconic images that nonetheless have been subjected to kind of like communal forgetting, where we're all outraged for a little bit of time, and then right. everyone moves on to the next thing to be outraged about. But I should say the first four people who read the manuscript had four entirely different interpretations of what the hell was going on in this book, which is not something I expected at all. But that's been, the reaction. I can't talk about it too much, but the reaction has been much more varied than I thought it would be.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, let us, I just looked down at the time and I'm like, want to ask you more questions, but let us start our last section here of the interview. And this is the final five questions. So this is essentially, I ask these same five questions. And before we were recording, this might be something new from the first time I interviewed you. I don't know. Maybe some of them came out. But anyways, I ask these same five questions to every author. And I do this just because I love the answers. And I also do it because, you know, a big part of this show is to encourage, to inspire writers to find their way to create. It is an individual process. Writing a novel, unless you're doing it with a co-author, is not a group project. And so you have to learn how you create. You have to learn what feels good, what's comfortable, what helps you get words on the page. And there's not one way. You know, it always surprises people when they're like, I really like to write at night, but I know you're supposed to wake up early. I'm just like, write whenever the hell you want. I mean, just write whenever you want. Doesn't matter. And so I'm hoping these answers show just how crazy diverse the authors have had on the show. Nobody says the same thing twice. So here we go. Question number one. What is the one word that best describes you?
Uncertain. As I'm answering these questions, I realize that it may well be that I'm contradicting every answer I gave in the first time we did this.
I know, we're going to mash them together.
The rank hypocrisy of my answers from one episode to another. I'm very much a deeply uncertain person. That makes it hard to develop any kind of public-facing brand, because I might second guess myself every time.
Okay, question number two. If you had to pick a spirit book, so this is like a book that if you died and you were able to be reincarnated as a book, it'd be the book you'd want to be reincarnated as. Like it really it really is who you want to be. What book would it be?
Who would I want to be as a book? There is, I'm trying to think because there's certain books where I think, you know, I want to experience this beauty of writing from within the work, but they're about super depressing topics. So, you know, my favorite novel, I think word for word, my favorite novel is A Death in the Family by James Agee, which I wouldn't even pick the whole book. I would pick the prologue and just exist as that prologue, which is someone thinking of a memory from childhood. And you can find this prologue. It's sitting around. The legend is that he wrote it in 90 minutes. He sat down and just wrote this thing. It's a page and a half or something like that. The rest of the book is incredibly depressing. It's about a death in the family. So that one springs to mind. I think this is an odd one, but I think A Confederacy of Dunces seems to me to be one of those books that gets at the heart of what a lot of living is, which is, you know, whenever anybody hears about A Confederacy of Dunces, it's always on the list of like the funniest books ever written, or like, you need to pick this up. It's so uproarious. And you pick it up and yeah, sure. I mean, the writing is amazing and it's funny as hell at some point, but really it's about a deep, deep sadness. It's about this kind of sense of being a complete alien in the world and not knowing your footing. And so I think my experience of life has always had that kind of bait and switch, you know, to it. None of these are satisfying answers, but I'm having such a hard time conceptualizing the idea of reincarnation as a book.
As a book. I like those answers. If something comes to you, we'll move on. If something comes to you, backwards. You can cross your list out. Someday I'm going to make a big, huge, when I get to 100 of these, I'm going to make a big, huge list of 100 authors and what book they'll be reincarnated as. It's going to be super fun. Anyways, okay, question number 3. Is there a specific tool? Can be anything at all, pencil, software, chair, coffee, wine, whatever, that you absolutely must have to write?
I've had the same desk for a quarter century.
Wow.
And it's not even a particularly good desk. It was given to me by an old college friend who was leaving town and didn't want to deal with this thing. It's very much a square piece of wood on four legs. There's nothing at all, you know, interesting about it. But it has all these notches and times where I can be like, oh, yeah, I know this one. That's when that sentence was just not working. You know, like it has this kind of archaeology of my many failures. I hate replacing things. I will use keyboards until like keys pop out and that sort of thing. And so everything else for mechanical reasons has actually failed. The keyboard that I wrote American War on, I would still be writing with today if it hadn't disintegrated, hadn't like, you know, to just fully put up, you know, the I quit sign. The desk is the last remnant. And I'm going to hold on to it until the moths get at it, never letting it go.
I love it. I don't know if I've ever had anyone say desk before. I think you're the first person to say desk. I've heard some people have said keyboards. Like some people were really into their keyboards, laptops, quiet music, all sorts of stuff, but never a desk. So there you go.
My wife got me a new keyboard and I'm really bad at it. Like my finger spacing is really bad. And at first I was going to throw it away, but then I realized that it forces me to write slower. And that gives me a little bit of more deliberation. So I've kept it.
Keyboards, the change they can make. All right, question number 4. How do you deal with the constant ups and downs of the writing life?
I try to tether myself to something that actually is important, by which I mean important personally to me. I don't mean to sort of say that literature isn't important or writing isn't important. I mean that in my life, I might have a really bad writing day. And then I write overnight sometimes. And then in the morning, I'll go up from the writing studio where I camp out. I'll go up to the big house where we live and my daughter will wake up and she'll run and give me a hug and she'll be really happy to see me. And some days I'll have a miserable writing night and that'll happen, or I'll have a great writing night and that'll happen. This morning, I was driving my wife and kids to the airport. They're going back to Canada for a bit to see family. And on the drive there, I got a call from my editor telling me that I'd been longlisted for this, I mean, what I think is an incredibly prestigious award that I certainly don't deserve, but it was this really nice bit of good news.
Yeah.
And my daughter didn't care in the slightest. She was excited to be hanging out and, you know, and so you get the ups and downs. American Award, yeah. I think, lost 13 awards, which has to be some kind of record for futility alone. And if you tie your sense of self-worth to that sort of stuff, you're in trouble. And to the best of my ability, I try to remind myself that there are parts of this life that are just so consistently full of love and wonder and joy. Mm. And that's what the anchor should be.
Mm. That's really beautiful. And congrats on the long list. I hope to see, I'm sure it's not public yet, but I'm hope to see the news on it.
It's by the time the podcast airs, I'm sure I will have already lost or been, you know, dropped out on the shortlist or something, but it was a really nice piece of news this morning.
Oh, great. Awesome. Okay. Last question for you. This is what I might've had. This question might've been here on the first interview, but here it is. If you could give one piece of advice to new writers out there, what would it be?
Be kind to yourself. Mm. We all know that the obvious writing advice, read as much as possible, write as much as possible, so on and so forth. But particularly when I was younger, I thought that self-loathing and this constant self-criticism was what real writers did. Mm. And that if you weren't doing it, you were going too easy on yourself. And it resulted in some really terrible writing that was also unenjoyable to write, which is like just the double whammy of mm-hmm. why not to write, you know. Mm-hmm. If it feels good and it reads bad, at least it felt good, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. If it feels bad and it reads good, at least you've got a prize. Cosmic events and anxiety produces, and a lot of times you're on the first of what could be 20 drafts mm-hmm. before you get to the place. It's a marathon, and unless you're good to yourself, you're going to drop out. Mm-hmm. So that would be my singular piece of advice. Just be kind to yourself, because this isn't easy.
I love that. Omar, where can people find you? Where are you on the internet? Where do you hang out? Are you tweeting, Instagramming, Facebooking, anything?
So I'm on Instagram, but I'm so bad at Instagram that I don't know the handle. It's just you can look for a guy named Omar who has two pictures up, and they're both just copies of my new book. I'm on Twitter, I think, as Omar Alakad, slightly less sporadically. And otherwise, my email is super easy to find. So flip me a note.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Omar, thank you so much. It's so good to have you on again. It's so good to kind of hear from you again. It's interesting kind of in the life of the podcast to start having guests on a second time is kind of an interesting feeling. It's new to me, but I'm so happy to talk to you again. So happy, with What Strange Paradise, and wishing the best of success and this award. Hope you win it. And it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you again to Omar for his time. If you haven't yet, please check us out on iTunes. Leave us a rating and review. Also, check me out on Instagram. You can find us under Happy Writer. Lastly, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, all over the place. And I want to say a special thank you to all you listeners out there. And I hope you have a wonderful week of writing.